come here and give this talk. So when I first got the invitation, I thought, why did I get an invitation to talk to this conference? What is the relation between, because the conference was meant to be on conformal gravity. And then I thought a little bit, and then I thought what I would try to do is I will try to summarize or discuss possible connections between conformal gravity and the ADS-CFT correspondence. Now, to start with, in ADS-CFT correspondence, one relates gravity in ADS to some non-gravitating conformal field theory in one dimension less. So superficially, it seems like there is no connection at all, because in the bulk, we have gravity, but the theory is not conformal. And in the boundary, the theory is conformal, but it does not contain gravity. So it doesn't seem like there is any relation. Nevertheless, as you will see during this talk, ADS-CFT leads to a systematic construction of conformal gravity coupled to conformal matter, and also leads to new results and intuition about these theories. So I think it's a worthwhile exercise to see what we can learn. Now, to do that, I will first have to spend some time to introduce the correspondence and some of the basics. So that would occupy roughly a quarter of my talk. So to start with, I like to start with some of the basics. So so the basically three main things that one has to know before start using ADS-CFT, and this is the main dictionary, which I summarize here. So the first thing is that bulk fields in the bulk of ADS corresponds to boundary operators. For example, the bulk metric corresponds to the boundary stress energy tensor. And if you have a bulk scalar field that has a certain mass, then this corresponds to a boundary operator of certain dimension. So that gives you the dictionary between, let's say, the words you use in the bulk to the words you use in the boundary theory. Now, ADS has a conformal boundary, which I will review in the next few slides. So this means that we need to impose boundary conditions there. And the fields that we use in order to impose these boundary conditions are identified with the sources for the dual operators. So now we want one step further. We don't just have a correspondence. We have a precise way to map the variables on the two sides. And the last element is about the dynamics. The dynamics and the dynamical statement is the following. So now if you compute the on-shell supergravity action, this is going to be a function of the fields that parameterize the boundary conditions. And this is identified with a generating functional of conformal field theory correlators. So basically, in most of the talk, we're going to be using again and again these three principles. Now, already from that dictionary, we're going to learn something which is somewhat non-trivial. Now, in quantum field theory, the sources are unconstrained. And this implies that if this correspondence makes sense, then this implies that the gravitational equations must admit a Dirichlet boundary problem, which is specified by arbitrary functions. Now, such Dirichlet problem is not always possible. For example, if one looks for a statically flat spacetime, the spacetimes do not admit such Dirichlet problem. But it turns out that the gravitational equations with a cosmological constant do admit such a variational problem. So I'd like to spend the next few slides explaining this point. So to get started, let's start with really the very basics. To get to the intuition, let's start with discussing identity the spacetime itself. So the metric in global coordinates is given over here, where this variable theta takes this range. So now the conformal boundary of the spacetime is at theta equals pi over 2. And then we can see that this metric over here blows up at that point. So, and because of that, this means there is no, this bulk metric diverges, so there's no well-defined boundary metric. However, there is a well-defined conformal structure. That, in other words, there's a well-defined metric up to Weyl transformation. So let me review that in somewhat more detail. Now, to obtain a boundary metric, so we've seen that naively there is no boundary metric, but let's suppose that we insist that trying to get a boundary metric in any case. So to do that, we're going to use a so-called defining function, namely a function of coordinates which is positive in the interior of spacetime but has a single zero at the boundary. And then we're going to define the object I give over here. So we multiply our Bach metric by R squared, and then we take the limit theta goes to pi over 2. Now, since R has a single zero and G has a second order pole, this product, this limit exists, so we can define this object. However, after we define this object, we can observe that instead of using this defining function, we may as well have used another one, which is related to the previous via this relation. So if this is positive and has a single zero at the boundary, this we have as well. So this is another good defining function. So this means that what we define is not really a metric, but we really define a metric up to a Val transformation, namely a conformal class. So in ADS itself, so to just to see an example, we can pick as our defining function R equals, yes. So the capital G is the bulk metric. The bulk metric, yeah. So just to see an example, we can pick as a defining function cosine theta. So if I multiply this by cosine theta, and then the limit theta goes to pi over 2 exists, and then we get this metric. However, this is just a representative of the entire conformal class. And moreover, this metric is conformally flat. So this means that any other conformally flat metric would be as good. For example, we may have used the flat metric. Actually, at least in the string theory literature, there is a little bit of misuse of language. So people would say this is the boundary when we use global coordinates, where if we use a flat metric, then we're using Poincaré coordinates. This is really a misnomer. So it's really, we're just using a different representative of the same conformal class. So now let's try to generalize. So first of all, most of the GR literature from the 80s, and here I list some of the papers, this discuss asymptotically ADS spacetimes by fixing a boundary metric to be the Einstein universe. But now for ADS CFT, this is not good enough because we want to parameterize boundary conditions by arbitrary functions, not specific metrics. So we like to generalize this in two ways. First of all, we like to keep fixed a conformal class because this is what is invariantly defined. And secondly, we would like this to be a general conformal class, not necessarily the flat conformal class. And we need this because we need this conformal class to be unconstrained because it's going to serve as a source for the stress energy tensor. And as I review a few slides back in quantum field theory, the sources are always unconstrained because we need to be able to differentiate with respect to them. Now, spacetimes of this type were considered in the mathematics literature around the same time where, let's say, in the physics literature, people discuss asymptotically ADS spacetimes, in particular in the work of Pfefferman and Graham. And I'm going to refer to the spacetimes as asymptotically locally under de Sitter, because if you go towards the boundary, they locally look like either de Sitter, but not globally. Okay, so now we'd like to construct space-time solutions with these boundary conditions. So we pick a representative of the conformal class and we try to solve Einstein equations. Now it turns out that this can be done in complete generality near a conformal boundary. And in this talk, I will focus in odd-dimensional space-times because this is the case which is relevant for the connection with conformal gravity. And I will only briefly mention the case of even-dimensional asymptotically locally ADS spacetimes. Now, near conformal infinity, we can always use coordinates such that the metric looks like that, where rho equals zero is the position of the conformal boundary. And now, if you insert this in Einstein equations, one finds that these equations, if you expand them in this radial variable, become algebraic equations, and they can be solved completely generally. Yeah, this is meant to be d rho squared. Okay, so let's see the structure of the solution. So So we have, this is the metric where Gij x comma rho is, has the following form. So this bold face G naught is our initial choice, can be anything. It can depend arbitrarily on the coordinates, the boundary coordinates. And then one finds that the blue coefficients are uniquely and locally determined in terms of G naught. But this red coefficient is not determined by asymptotics, only its trace and the divergence is determined. So that coefficient is the most important coefficient from the perspective of the ADA CFT correspondence, because it encodes the dynamics of the boundary theory. But for the perspective of this talk, this is not important. So more important is the coefficient next to it that multiplies the logarithm. So in the mathematics literature, this is called the obstruction tensor. And it will play an important role in our story. It's called obstruction tensor because obstructs the, in a sense, the having a purely polynomial solution near the boundary. Okay, so now we have obtained the general asymptotic solution given boundary metric. So the next thing in ADS-CFT correspondence is to now compute the on-cell action, because this is going to give us the dynamics. But now when we try to do this, the first thing we find is that actually the answer is infinite, basically because of the infinite volume of space-time, and we have to find a way to make sense out of it. So to regulate this infinity, we're going to cut off the space-time at some point rho equals epsilon, where epsilon is some small quantity, and then evaluate the on-shell action on that regulated space-time. So then when you do this, the answer that one gets is the following. So there is a number of parallel divergences, and there is a logarithmic divergence. And it turns out that all of them, all of these coefficients, depend locally on the chosen representative G-naught. Okay, so now we understood the structure of infinities for the most general asymptotically locally ADS space-time. And next, we'd like to renormalize. To renormalize, we need to add boundary counter terms. So basically, we're going to add a local expression here, such that when I add it to the previous regulated expression, then this limit epsilon go to zero makes sense. And then the final answer, which is the renormalized action, is finite. And does not depend on epsilon anymore. Now it turns out that this regulated action can be computed starting from this expression and is given by this expression. So the power law divergences, the ones over here, give rise to local terms. And we still have this logarithmic piece. Okay, so now we have a well-defined action. It's finite. So now we can ask whether this on-cell finite action now depends only on the conformal class or depends on the specific representative we started from. So it turns out this normalized action does depend on the representative, so there is an anomaly. So if you consider infinitesimal sigma, then the anomaly turns out to be precisely the coefficient of this logarithmic term. Now, if it would be in even bulk dimensions, there is no such anomaly. And in that case, the normalized on-shell action actually depends only on the conformal class, not just the representative. Okay, so let me briefly discuss some of the properties of the anomaly. So now I define the anomaly, the integral of this guy, so without the sigma effects. And this has the following properties. So the anomaly itself is a conformal invariant. So this means it just depends on the conformal class of the original metric, but not on the specific representative. And secondly, the obstruction tensor, this coefficient of the logarithm over here, is just the variation of the anomaly with respect to the metric. So the two logarithms that we find in this procedure, so one was a logarithm in the asymptotic solution of the metric, and the second was a logarithm in the on cell value reaction are actually linked via this formula. Okay. So I said earlier that we wanted to generalize the variational, to generalize the boundary value problem by first trying to get a variational problem which only depends on the conformal class. And secondly, that this conformal class should be general. So I did, we started with a general class and a general representative. We managed to find a finite on-shell action. So the next thing is to go back to that and re-examine the variational problem. Now, in even dimensions, if we try to impose, to have a well-posed variational problem where what we keep fixed is a conformal class, then this requires to adding additional boundary terms to the action on top of the usual Gibbon, Hawking, York term. And these additional boundary terms are precisely the boundary counter terms I discussed in the previous slides. So the boundary counter terms are not just needed for finiteness, also needed for having a well-defined variational problem where what you keep fixed is the natural quantity. Now, in all dimensions, it turns out one has to specify a representative of the conformal class for the variational problem to be well-posed. And this is precisely related to the anomaly. So this is, again, the statement of the anomaly. And in this case, the boundary counter terms ensure that the dependence of the theory on this representative is governed only by the anomaly, which itself depends only on the conformal class. So at the end, all the defining properties of the theory is really the conformal class of the metric. If you give, if you're given a conformal class of the metric, you can obtain a space-time, and you know how the theory changes when you move from one representative to the next, and the transformation itself just comes from the conformal class. Okay, so that, this was my review of ADS-CFT. So before I, next, I'm gonna connect to conformal gravity. So do you have any questions or comments before I move to that?
So, when you say that there is no conformal anomaly in even bulk dimensions, so that's
yes.
Your statement, right?
Yes.
So this is, so is it equivalent to saying that there is no conformal anomaly in
ADS4, ADS6, etc.
But then, so this means that the CFT doesn't have any conformal anomaly?
Yeah, the CFT doesn't have an anomaly.
So the CFT in three dimensions
does not have a conformal anomaly.
So then I'm a bit confused because I thought yesterday Petr was talking about conformal anomaly of a three-dimensional theory.
It was not relativistic. This is only true for relativistic field theories. So what I was talking about yesterday is the sequel to this story when you go from relativistic to non-relativistic holography. It requires extensions and there are more possible anomalies, in particular in 2 plus 1, you get an anomaly when z is equal to 2. So anisotropic scaling between time and space.
So a space was two-dimensional.
Space is two-dimensional.
Okay, so that's
so right. You are indeed in three dimensions on the boundary, but the non-relativistic scaling allows for an anomaly, actually, two different anomalies.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Okay, any other question? Okay, so now let's move to what I would call holographic conformal gravity. So what I just told you is how to construct conformal gravity and what is its field equations. So if you take the Lagrangian and the coefficient of the logarithmic term, then I just told you this is conformal invariant. And I also told you that the coefficient of the logarithmic piece in the asymptotic expansion of the metric is just the metric variation of that guy. So it's the field equations of that theory. So let's see how this look like in the low dimensional case. So let's first look at d equals 4. In d equals 4, this coefficient a4, if you compute it, it's just given by that expression. And I guess some people would recognize that. You can rewrite this as the order density plus val square. And at the same time, so the anomaly has, this expression has a multitude of realizations. This is also the conformal anomaly of the n equals 4 Young-Mills theory. And this provides a highly non-trivial check of the ADS-CFT correspondence because the computations are completely different. In the context of n equals 4, one looks at the UV properties of the theory, where here we just look at the let's say, infrared behavior of a gravitational theory.
And by that, you mean numerical coefficients?
Yes, exactly, yes.
You're not showing numerical coefficients?
Yes, but if you look at the paper, we really check the numerical coefficient, yes. Now, in six dimensions, the expression is slightly more complicated. And in this case, this can also be expressed as similar to the previous case over here. So we have the Euler density, and we have a linear combination of the three independent value invariants, plus a total derivative, where these AIs are specific numerical coefficients. And again, like in the four-dimensional case, this is the Wien anomaly of the 2.0 theory in six dimensions. Okay, so now next I'm going to discuss the properties of these theories. And I'm going to, okay, first let me tell you the statement. So this holographic conformal gravities have the special property that any solution of Einstein gravity with or without cosmological constant is also a solution of the holographic conformal gravity. So I'm going to present two proofs of that statement. To some extent, the statement, I think, is known in the mathematics literature, although I have not seen the proofs, but I believe it is known at least to some extent.
But not the reverse.
Not the reverse, of course. Yeah, there are more. And actually, we will be able to, although I'm not going to demonstrate it here, but one can easily see what are the rest, as you will see a few slides down the road. Oh, absolutely. So now you start, in a sense, a new talk.
Sorry.
So if I go back, so here I kind of said, okay, this term is important for ADA CFT because it's related to the energy momentum tensor of the dual theory. At the same time, you can start from that and then define a notion of conserved charge. And actually, you can do more, because in this case, you can actually prove from first principles that this is the conserved charge of the theory by using an analog of, let's say, Noether's theorem. Many people try to use kind of Noether's theorem to define conserved charges in the GR before. But the usual problem is that you do not have control over the infinities that you get from asymptotics. So you have to rely on some prescription of how to make sense of formal manipulations. The new thing here is that you actually have full control over the asymptotics. And then this means that the formal arguments that people used in the past, you can make them completely rigorous. Okay. This is done in this paper as well. So we have a complete proof that this provides all conserved charges. You can also compute the symplectic structure in covariant phase space and all of that.
So that's very good, but I just wanted to ask, when the class of solutions of the conformal gravity, which are solutions of the Einstein equations, are they characterized by something like zero charge or zero energy?
I haven't looked at it yet. So this was a statement about Einstein gravity, but one can easily try to... One can try to investigate that in this framework as well. Good. Okay, so proofs. So the first is a holographic proof. Okay, so here how it goes. So one can prove by straightforward computation that the metric that I give you over here just solves Einstein equations. You just take the metric, put it in Einstein equations, and then after a few lines of algebra, then you find this is solved, provided G naught is an Einstein metric in the dimensions of with or without cosmological constant and with the Fermi sign. Okay. But now recall that I told you earlier that Hij, this abstraction tensor, is uniquely determined and locally in terms of G naught. Now, this metric over here does not have a logarithmic piece, which means that Hij is equal to zero when G naught is an Einstein metric. So just proving for you that these conformal gravities have solutions arbitrary Einstein metrics. Actually, this tensor only depends on the conformal structure. So what you need is you need a metric which is conformal to Einstein. And I believe that statement was known in the math literature. And in particular, the D equals 4 case is known for almost 100 years. Because that tensor is the Bach tensor. Okay. So now let me give you an alternative proof, which is somewhat more explicit and gives a little bit more information. So the other one was slick and quick. In a sense, you had to guess this metric. Once you guess that metric, the rest is immediate. So first I'm going to do the case of, let's say, the Ricci flat metrics. So here I list again the Lagrangians. But now if you look at the Lagrangians, you can see that both of them are at least quadratic in the Ricci curvature. So this means that if I compute the field equations are going to be linear in the Ricci equation. So Ricci flat metrics would solve the field equations. So what remains to be done is to do the cases where the metric is Einstein, but with a cosmological constant. So then let me focus now on that case. So then one can show that the Lagrangians I listed over here can be rewritten in this form, where L naught is the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, and Eij is just the corresponding Einstein equations. And this tensor here has the forms I indicate over here with specific numerical coefficients. So now once we have this, then we're pretty much done. Because if we now work out the field equations, these are going to be linear in Einstein equations, since this piece is quadratic and the variation of that just gives Einstein equations, which means that any solution of Einstein equations is also a solution of the conformal gravity. Yes?
Yeah, I may be remembering wrong, but I think a long time ago, Gary Horowitz pointed out the second argument and also claimed that the energy of the conformal gravity is zero for the solutions which are Einstein.
I see, okay. I don't know that paper, so maybe you can tell me.
It's a long time ago. This was part of an attempt to answer the argument, the criticism that conformal gravity has instabilities.
Ah, I see. Okay.
Question? Sorry, I'm a little confused about the last argument, because that looked like it held for the Einstein equations with a particular cosmological constant. Does lambda somehow drop out?
No. So here, lambda not here denotes the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian with a cosmological constant appropriate for the one I choose over there.
Ah,
so lambda does not drop out.
An arbitrary one.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And also the coefficients, these coefficients are inversely proportional to 1 over lambda square. So that's why this argument is not good for Ricci flat. So that's why I had to do Ricci flat first.
Okay.
So furthermore, one can identify which of the solutions are Einstein via an initial value formulation. And I think the argument that I know is from Michael Anderson from 2004, where he did this in complete generality. And Maldacena also had a paper last year where he revisited that. But this reformulation also makes fairly simple to analyze the class of solutions which are not Einstein, because it's clear from where they're coming. So when you vary this, then you partially integrate one of these terms, and then you get the additional term. So I think it's fairly easy to analyze this second class as well. Okay, so next I'm gonna have a few comments about so-called critical gravity, but are there any questions on this part?
So if it's the same as Einstein gravity, then why do we care about it?
Why do we care about it? Well, first of all, this is an extremely useful formulation. For instance, if you wanna prove global stability of solutions, and that's why Mike Anderson looked at this, because it allows you to, let's say, reformulate the initial value problem for finite time for free. So in particular, he proved that if you have solutions which are asymptotically de Sitter, these are globally stable in the sense that if you start with some initial value problem and then you change the initial conditions by a little bit, then the behavior at play times is going to deviate a little bit from the behavior of the original solution. So it allows you to do this such sort of things.
So you're talking about conformal gravity or Einstein gravity
now? So suppose you want to analyze the behavior of solutions of Einstein gravity. And then, so in general, that's a difficult problem because you have to think about infinite evolution. But if you embed that theory in conformal gravity, since the theory is now conformal, you can now bring the infinity to finite interval. And then you can analyze, and then you have to only analyze the behavior of equations for finite time interval, which is an easier mathematical problem. And then infer conclusion for the other theory. So that's, let's say, one of the math uses. Now for physics, okay, it's not entirely clear to me what these things are good for. Yes?
You're talking about Einstein metric. Which dimension is this metric of?
So here it was 4 and 6. So this was the my two examples are 4-dimensional and 6-dimensional. Yes?
So just understand where you're going. In the usual ADS CFT, you get a correspondent in a gravitational theory in the ADS and a CFT which is in on a flat.
Correct. Well, and it doesn't have to be in flat. It doesn't have to be in flat.
So what you're going after is a CFT which is actually formulated on a non-flat background. But it's
yes.
Not gravitational, it's just a background.
Yeah, exactly. And then I use this, in a sense, as a spin-off to understand conformal gravity. It says that's a spin-off of trying to understand the correspondence more generally than for flat backgrounds. And since the title of the conference was conformal gravity, so I thought I will discuss this type of spin-off.
But there was also a universe in it, so it has something to do with the universe.
Well, okay, so maybe that's more relevant for our universe. So recently, there had also been a renewed interest in higher derivative gravities. For instance, gravities of that form. So we have the Einstein-Hilbert, and then we have some high derivative terms with some coefficients alpha and beta. Now, for general alpha and beta, this theory describes the propagation of a massless spin 2 field, a massive spin 2 field, and a massive scalar. And then in a paper last year, Lu and Pop, and I suppose others, observed that the spectrum of linearized perturbations around ABS is spatial in two cases. One, so first of all, if you take these coefficients to have that relation, then the massive scalar is absent. And if in addition you impose that beta is now given by this specific relation, then the massive graviton becomes massless. And they call this theory critical gravity because of this property. So for generic value, you have this field constant, but then the field constant becomes sort of the same as that of Einstein theory. And they did this by starting from the field equations, linearizing, and then look at the spectrum of linearized perturbations. Now, it is easy to understand these properties and many of the other special properties that they pointed out in the papers using this reformulation that I just discussed. So first, when alpha is equal to -3, then this high derivative term becomes this. And this combination here is precisely the holographic conformal anomaly I discussed earlier. And we just discussed a rewriting of that theory in terms of like so. So if you put all coefficients precisely in, then you get the relation that I give over here. So this theory here is equivalent to that. And then in critical gravity, the coefficient beta was chosen to be -1/2 lambda, so this drops out. And that theory just becomes a square of Einstein equations. Yes?
So I'm a little bit confused about, I mean, I was not aware of this result that you're quoting by Pope company, but I do remember from way back in the 80s that hard derivative gravity has the problem that these additional states that you discover have the wrong sign residue, and they're actually ghosts. So they're very massive, but unitarity gets completely.
Yeah, so here they wanted, in a sense, to. So the RU generically has these problems, but if I tune the parameters to become spatial, then the massive gravitons go away, and then you're just left with the usual graviton, so to speak.
But are they still ghosts? Just because you collapse the massive hole onto zero doesn't mean it's not a ghost.
Yeah, so then at the linearized level, there's no problem. And then, they start looking at the black holes, and they see they have special properties, et cetera. So here, I'm just explaining the properties. Yes?
Yeah, there's some argument that at this tuning of coefficients, that's exactly the place where the theory becomes non-normalizable as well. Normally, the higher derivatives make it renormalizable, but there was one paper a little while ago that analyzed it at one loop and showed that exactly there things blew up.
I see, it's okay. But then from here we see. Here we see why you have the special property. So once this is gone, then it's clear that you only have, let's say, the usual, the linearized level, you have the usual spectrum. And you also see why the theories have a special, some of the properties are special. I have this. Yeah, like here, for instance, the on-shell action. So they, for instance, they found that the on-shell action was zero for some of the black holes, but it's clearly zero because it's quadratic in the field equations. So this, in a sense, explains many of these results that look at first surprising, but the actual action is very special. Okay, so next I'm gonna start to add conformal matter. So before I do that, any more comments about the critical gravity? Yeah, that connects. Yes.
I kind of missed the conclusion of this discussion. That is that point a good point or a bad point?
This theory is just in a sense the square of Einstein equations. That's why it looks special. I don't think.
But is there? Does it have ghosts or doesn't it? Do you know that?
Well, I mean, in the quantum theory, I think it would have. It would behave. So.
I'm sorry, it would be well behaved?
Ill behaved.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what I would say. Yeah. The whole class of all the parameters of these theories were studied a long time ago with an eye to getting rid of the ghost and rescuing unitarity. And I don't think, I think they were all equally non unitary.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
If you had the Einstein field equations and you square them, it would still be of the same order of differentials. But since you have that as part of the Lagrangian, you vary that to get your equation motion, you have higher order.
Absolutely, yes. So you have, let's say, the special cases, which are, in terms of solutions, you have the solutions which are Einstein, and then there are other solutions because it's high order differential equation. And for the same reasons in the quantum theory, you're going to have high order poles in the propagators. Which would lead to non-unitarity.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, this was more meant to illustrate that some of the properties are easy to understand because, in a sense, they look magical if you start with these complicated field equations and then you linearize them and then you study them. It would look like miracles happening, but it's somewhat easy to understand the miracles once you reformulate the action in this fashion. Okay, so I think this is going to connect with some of the morning's talk. So now we'd like to understand how to add matter to this conformal gravity. And this can be done very simply by just doing the same thing we did for Einstein gravity, but now we do Einstein gravity coupled to matter. Of course, not all bulk matter fields would lead to conformal matter couplings in the theory. And it's easy to understand which ones it would. So the mass should be such that the boundary field, which is the source of the dual operator, has a dimension that allows for interaction terms of dimension D. So let me give you an example to illustrate this long sentence. So if I have a scalar field phi of mass minus 3 in ADS 5, then using the formula I had in the beginning of the talk, then one can see that the dual field has dimension 3, which means that its source has dimension 1. And this means you can have terms of dimension 4. So here I listed 2. So this is a good case. So if you start with ADS gravity coupled to the scalar field with that dimension, then you're going to end up following the procedure I'm going to describe in a few slides to conformal gravity coupled to conformal matter. So how do you do that? You do exactly the same we did earlier. So we start by finding the general asymptotic solution of gravity coupled to matter. As I said earlier, this involves algebraic steps, can always be done. And then one finds that the metric has the same asymptotic structure I wrote earlier. And the scalar has an expansion of the form I indicate over here. So there is a leading order piece, which depends on the dimension of the dual operator. Then phi naught is the arbitrary source. This is the input. This is the Dirichlet data. And then blue coefficients are, again, determined uniquely and locally in terms of phi naught. And the red coefficient is not determined by asymptotics, but is related by ADS CFT to the expectation value of the dual operator. Now we have the general solution. We're applying it in the action. And then there is, again, a logarithmic divergence, where and the coefficient AD, the new coefficient AD, is now, again, conformal invariant. And again, as before, there is a logarithmic piece in the expansion of the metric, which is, again, given by the variation of this anomaly with respect to the metric. And this new coefficient over here is now the variation of the new anomaly with respect to that source. So the same discussion I had earlier just goes through straightforwardly. It's the computations are a little bit longer, but it's the same idea. So that's how we get now conformal gravity coupled to conformal matter. And let's just give you an example taken from a paper from 10 years ago. So suppose we start from this action. So we have a scalar with this potential. Actually, the fact that it terminates to the 5 to the 4 is not important. But OK, this leading order terms are important. And then if you follow that procedure, then one finds the anomaly I indicate over here. So this is the piece we had earlier. And here we see that we automatically land into conformal gravity coupled to conformal scalar. Now here, this operator here, which is, of course, the one on conformal Laplacian, we just landed on it. It's not an input. And if we didn't know that this is a special operator, we had to discover it. We could have discovered it this way. So this leads me to, let's say, the last topic of my talk, which is conformal differential operators. So conformal differential operators are differential operators that have nice transformation rules. Namely, if you do a conformal transformation, then the rule depends only on sigma, but not on derivatives of sigma. So an example is precisely the conformal Laplacian I had earlier that has this nice transformation rule, does not involve derivatives. And an active area of research in mathematics is about the form and properties of such operators, because then you can use them to characterize conformal manifolds in conformal geometry. And there's lots of work, and it's, I think Graham is doing lots of work in that area. So I wrote this as a P1 because it's the first element of a big family. So you can define conformal operators of weight d over 2 plus k as operators that transform like so. So k equals 1 was the first family. And this is a conformal differential operator, which is a generalization of the kth power of the Laplacian. If you set the curvature to 0, then this is going to be the Laplacian to the kth order, to leading order. And up until a few years ago, basically only the k equals 1 and k equals 2 members of that family were known explicitly. And even the, let's say, the existence of the property of high order ones was not very clear. Now, if you want to explicitly construct those guys, it's now fairly simple in this context. So what you need to do is you start with ADS. You couple this to scalar field of that mass, where this k is the same k, and just compute the log divergence in the action. This you're going to launch to that operator. And one can also use this method to construct non-scalar conformal operators as well. You just have to, instead of discussing scalar fields, you just add some other field in the bulk and do the same procedure. For instance, if you start with ADS gravity coupled to Maxwell field in the bulk, then you're going to find the Maxwell operator in four dimensions, et cetera. So I think it gives you an algorithm to construct all of those guys. Any questions on this?
So k,
yes.
K has to be an integer.
Hmm?
Does k have to be an integer?
In this case, yes, it has to be an integer in this case. Okay, so let me then conclude. So I think the two main things I discussed today. First of all, I told you how to obtain conformal gravity coupled to conformal matter using ADS-CFT. And we also discussed several special properties of these theories. So in the first part, the way to do it is we start from ADS gravity coupled to matter fields in D plus one dimensions. And then we solve for the asymptotic field equations. This is an algebraic step, can always be done. And if there is a logarithmic term in the asymptotic solution, then this is just the field equation of the corresponding conformal gravity coupled to conformal matter. And the actual action you can get by the logarithmic logarithmic counter term. So this gives you the action and the field equations at the same time. And in terms of properties, so we derive the relation between what I call holographic conformal gravity, namely the conformal gravity we get via that procedure, and Einstein gravity. And we use this to explain some of the special properties of critical gravity. And the last part, I'll show you how to construct conformal differential operators using this procedure. Thank you.
In random syndrome 2, one can understand the random syndrome construction by gravity coupled to conformal matter on the brain. So is there any link between what you have done and the random syndrome model?
Yeah, so if you consider the theory at the cutoff surface without removing the cutoff, that's morally speaking the Randall syndrome. That's why there is the connection.
Program for full type 2D strings, when you get n equals 4 conformal gravity on the boundary.
Yes.
With a fixed conformal class,
no
choice, non-dynamic.
Yes. Yeah, so if I do this, if I start from the entire let's say supergravity in five dimensions, n equals 8, this is going to give the maximal supersymmetric conformal supergravity.
My question was that theory, n equals 4 conformal supergravity in MILS, is supposed to be special if you choose the gauge group in a very careful way. Do you see any echo of that?
I mean, you do not see the gauge group in gauge gravity duality. You only see, in a sense, the gauge invariant observables. So, and you can formulate also, so now you do not see the. Yes?
So you showed at one point that from this construction, you automatically get the correct anomaly for the A and Z anomaly.
Yes.
For n equal 4.
Right.
But you never actually put into the calculation the full n equal 4 construction.
Very good, yes.
So does that mean that gauge criticality will only work for theories which have that ANC?
Yes, exactly. So this is one of the very few, no-go theorems for gauge gravity duality. So if you have a quantum field theory, conformal field theory, you can ask, does it have a holographic dual? So if you're four dimensions, then if the Lagrangian limit A is different than C, then it does not have a holographic dual. Or does not have a holographic dual that has a low energy limit. Because what I use a low energy limit where I can compute things using supergravity. And the reason I did not have to use any of the other fields is because the conformal anomaly, in order to compute the conformal anomaly, I only need to have control over the expectation value of the stress energy tensor. So I only need the source of the stress energy tensor. I can set all other sources to zero because they're irrelevant. I'm not interested in the other operators.
You said, but not only does A have to equal C, but they have to equal specific numbers that you said you compute,
yes,
right?
Yes, in the large end limit, yes.
So are there any theories other than N equals 4 for which duality works?
No, there are many other theories. So, you know, in the sense, everything in the same universality. So if you start from N equals 4 and then, let's say, you put a relevant coupling, then all of this. But there are theories which are not in that class. There are conformal theories which do not have A equals C in the large end limit. So it's not a vacuous restriction.
So you mentioned it briefly, but can you explain a bit more, you know, what the applications of conformal differential operators?
Well, it's as I said, it's an active area of research in mathematics because they want to study, like, conformal manifolds in the sense of generalization of Riemann surfaces in two dimensions. And then you want, in two dimensions, you have, you know, lots of things about the Riemannian manifolds. So you would like to find similar properties for high dimensional versions. And this differential operators are used in such fashion.
No further questions for now.